All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's monthly policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a research assistant here with GTI.
And I am Jack Liu. I'm program associate at GTI.
All right. Today, we're so excited to be joined by Dr. Ming Shou Ho. Dr. Ho is a professor at National Taiwan University in Taipei, where he teaches sociology. Focused on the complex relationship between social movements, identity, and politics, he's written on a wide range of interesting topics related to Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China. Ming Shou is also the author of two amazing books, honestly, Working Class Formation in Taiwan, Fractured Solidarity and State-Owned Enterprises from 1945 to 2012, and Challenging Beijing's Mandate of Heaven, Taiwan's Sunflower Movement and Hong Kong's Umbrella Movement, which we're really excited to talk about today. I think it's, you know, a really great time to talk about it. Ming Shou, we're so glad you could join us today. How are things in Taiwan?
Hi, it's very good here. Yeah, save it.
Good, good. That sounds nice compared to DC right now. Well, Dr. Ho, I think your book has really come in a really interesting and worrisome time. You know, I think there's so much attention being paid to Hong Kong right now. And I think despite that, there's not a lot of understanding of the events that really led up to this current protests, right? But in recent months, you know, we've seen Beijing draft and then implement its national security law in Hong Kong. We've seen Beijing cracking down on huge amounts of demonstrators in Hong Kong and really working to systematically stamp out dissent. And you've really seen Hong Kong's autonomy get eroded. And I think it's such a good time to talk to you, given your expertise on these past social movements and the relationships with China. So we're really excited to talk to you and just sort of get some more insight into this matter.
Yeah, sure. Of course, I'd love to share my book, what my book is about, and also its relation to the ongoing issue in Hong Kong.
Perfect. Great. Well, just to begin, you know, Dr. Ho, I think your book does a great job of really giving a history, you know, a recent history of these movements that were so influential in both Taiwan and Hong Kong. You know, I think there's not enough talk about the context of both the Sunflower Movement in Taiwan and the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong, and how amazing these movements were and, you know, how influential they were. I think an interesting thing that you talk about a lot is sort of the linkages between these two, how they were sort of self-reinforcing. So to begin, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what motivated you to write about this topic. What made you feel like this was the time to talk about these movements that happened way back in 2014?
Yes. I'd love to share a little bit about my background and my personal intellectual journey. Actually, I began as an observer, a student of Taiwan social movement. As you probably know, social movement in Taiwan in the past 30 years have been making great change on Taiwan. Like, for example, Taiwan is the first Asian country to legalize same-sex marriage last year. And I also began, I began only focusing on Taiwan only. But as you know, that I've been always in contact with social movement activists. But beginning around 2012, I noticed that their conversation often referred to Hong Kong. And on the side of Hong Kong, they are also discussing about Taiwan. I think I just follow the activist. And what happened is that since 2012, there have been more cross-fertilization on both sides, on both civil society. And the main issue is, of course, the increasingly strong presence of China in both society. So what happened in 2012 was two movements that are separate, but actually they equal each other. In Hong Kong, it's an issue about protest against national education, and the leader was Joshua Wong, who was actually a teenager at the time. And in Taiwan, it was about an issue of the media monopoly. A pro-China media conglomerate is going to expand, and student protest against that. So two sides are beginning to get to know each other. And so when Sunflower Movement happened in March 2014, there have been a lot of attention coming from Hong Kong. And that actually, it does not get started with the Sunflower Movement, but there have been several years in the making. So I just follow what people on the social movement circle were doing. And then in September of that year, Hong Kong's Umbrella Movement erupted. So also it drew a lot of attention from Taiwan. And I think that's the really beginning of the exchange and the collaboration of activists on two societies.
Yes, Dr. Minxiao. I'm sorry, Minxiao. Yeah, you mentioned that there's like so the linkage between the two movement, and I think you also, it's a very interesting point that you also discussed this in your book, and also like the relationship between these two movement, the umbrella movements and the sunflower movement, and you also make it clear that the two movement influence one another in your book and what you just have said. So both like ideologically and logistically. So could you just talk a little bit more about the link between the sunflower and umbrella movement, just a little bit deeper?
Yeah, sure. On the appearance, the two movements are actually about separate issues. Sunflower movement is a protest against a free trade treaty with China. And in the side of Hong Kong, umbrella movement is about the genuine suffrage of the top leaders. They are different issues. But what happened is that before the eruption of Hong Kong's umbrella movement, starting in 2013, there had been a campaign called Occupy Central with Love and Peace. It was led by two professors and one priest. And the goal was they want to strive for a genuine a direct election of chief executive. So they have been bargaining about that. And one of the tactic of that movement is that one, if Beijing does not allow Hong Kong people to elect freely of their leader as the basic law has promised, they are going to occupy Central. Central refer to the financial center in Hong Kong. Right. So the movement has got started over 1 year, and somehow it did not really take off because people people who support the democratic cause got impatient. They think they should do it right now because Beijing has not responded to their. And people who oppose that those pro-Beijing camp are already organizing. So when Sunflower Movement happened in March 2014, that was actually in the Hong Kong's campaign was in a kind of a crisis. But suddenly Hong Kong people witnessed that Taiwan students just went into the legislature and occupied there for 3 weeks. And eventually they even claimed that they won the movement. So that's a great inspiration for young people in Hong Kong, particularly students. So you see that after Sunflower Movement, the organizing and the protesting get more and more intense, and everything led up to the Sunflower Movement. I'm sorry, Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong.
Sure. It's so interesting seeing these two movements that were so influential happen so close together. I mean, it's clear that it really was a sort of wave of protest. I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. Think such an interesting part of this is that Taiwan and Hong Kong are really two interesting places that have a really fascinating relationship with Taiwan, with China across the strait. I mean, they really have this sort of conflictual relationship in terms of identity. I think there's a really interesting link that you explore a lot in the book between identity and these social movements and the sunflower and umbrella movements. And I think right now, you know, I think there's been a lot of publicization of some recent polls, both in Taiwan and Hong Kong, that really showed this really interesting increase in the number of citizens who define themselves as either Taiwanese or, you know, some combination of Taiwanese and Chinese, and similar in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. You know, this movement away from a strict Chinese identity more to something independent and unique. And I think that plays such an interesting role, as you explore in the book, in these social movements. Yeah. So I'd love to hear your opinion on this. You know, have these social movements helped to drive this shift away from Chinese identity? Or do you think it's the other way around? Has this shift away from Chinese identification served as a motivator for these social movements? Has people becoming more independent and identifying as something else served as kind of an impetus for more protest?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, it's a circular, it's interchange. I mean, within social movement and identity, that the more and more people identify themselves as indigenous people, and the more willing they are want to attend the social movement. And based on their experience of social movement, which is always usually frustrating, and they become more and more like more and more deep in their identity. So it's kind of an interchange. And I think that the relationship has to do with the problematic relationship with China in both societies, because of the issue is about China. Because in sunflower movement is actually an expression of anxiety that Taiwan is going to be economically incorporated into China, to the extent that Taiwan is going to lose autonomy. And people really got angry because when the ruling party at that time, Kuomintang, violated the procedure, democratic procedure, just to rush to the free trade agreement. So people really look at the political dimension of it. Whereas at that time, the ruling party just emphasized the economic benefit. So there's a disconnect between people who were worried and the people who were in charge of these things. And what is in Hong Kong, I think it's the same kind of, you may say, desperation, because both in Hong Kong and Taiwan, you see, since 2008, the people who identify themselves as indigenous in Taiwan will be Taiwanese, and in Hong Kong will be Hong Konger, it began to rise. And so it's actually a very important driving dynamic of these two movements. But what happened in Hong Kong is that the rise of a Hong Kong identity is more compressed. And there's a sense of urgency that the city is becoming assimilated into a regular mainland city. Hong Kong identity, Hong Kong culture is going to be erased. So it's kind of this anxiety that is really a driving force of the Hong Kong protest from umbrella movement to what you see right now in Hong Kong. So again, I would agree with Marshall that the identity is really a driving force. And but at the same time, it's out of this social movement experience, the young people's experience on the street that confirm their identity even more.
Right. I think that's really interesting.
That's really interesting that you also mentioned in your response that specifically the young people has been participating in this movement. So I do want to talk more about that groups of people. So as like everyone know, both the Sunflower Movement and the Umbrella Movement feature unprecedented like political engagement on the part of younger generations. Mm-hmm. And so why do you think it is the youth that have come to the forefront of social movement in Hong Kong and Taiwan? Are there specific generations factors that explain their frustration or grievances? Or there's political activism and to challenge the once prevalent views that they are like the soft strawberry tomato?
Yeah. Okay. Let me begin with the soft strawberries. That is the derogatory term applied to Taiwan youth that have been in place I think it's more than 10 years, because strawberry is a fruit that looks nice upon the outside, but it cannot withstand pressure. So that is often a term applied to younger generation by elder generation, meaning that they are not willing to work hard, endure hardship, whereas the previous generation that make the Taiwan economic miracle really, really are hardworking. But I would say that that's a stereotype, and young people really hate that term. So strawberry is really good for nothing. Actually, in Hong Kong, you also have the same expression that the youth are useless and they are totally waste, something like that. But let me come back to the younger generation. Actually, globally, I think the youth are the driving force of contemporary protests. That's not only limited to Hong Kong or Taiwan, it's a global phenomenon. And since 2011, we have like Arab Spring, we have like Occupy Wall Street, and everywhere you see young people are in the forefront of this protest. There are several reasons. I think young people are facing economic hardship regardless of the countries where they find themselves, and regardless of the level of economic development. You have Europe, Southern Europe, like in 2007, the debt crisis, young people were not angry about that, were not happy about that. And the second reason, I think younger people are more frequently found in the project is because these young people who are born in the after 80s or 90s are the so-called digital natives. So they are technologically savvy. They know how to use a lot of social media to assess the news. And also when they protest, they know how to make the news. So they are actually well-equipped for being a social movement participant. That's a global phenomenon. But in Taiwan and Hong Kong, I think they are local factor. Because in Taiwan, we have democratization very recent. So people who were born in the 80s or 90s, they didn't grow up in a highly indoctrinated environment, and they don't know what white terror means, and they don't really have experience of authoritarian rule or martial law. And also in the curriculum have been reformed. So like when I was born in the 73. So when I grew up, so it's still ideological. I mean, all the texts we talk about China and nothing about Taiwan. It's totally a China-centered curriculum. But in the 90s, the government began to reform that curriculum. So you see that people who might be born in the late 80s, when they went to primary school around mid-90s, the school they entered already changed. So that's one generational factor in Taiwan. So they don't have fear. And whereas people like me, we know what it used to be in a very repressive environment. In Hong Kong, I think it's another factor that Hong Kong transitioned to Chinese sovereignty in 97. Mm-hmm. So people who were born in the 80s, in the 90s, these are the main participants of the umbrella, actually had only limited experience of colonial period. But what happened is that elder Hong Kongers, when they grew up in colonial society, actually identify themselves as Chinese even stronger because it's a city ruled by the British.
Sure.
So it's quite interesting that in a formative era that they have this kind of ingrained experience identity that they were Chinese and they need to be patriotic, actually outlive what the following development. Whereas younger generation, you will look at the extradition protests in Hong Kong last year, a lot of people who were arrested were just teenagers, people who were as old as 11 or 12. They were born in this century. They don't even have experience of colonialism, and they don't have experience of Hong Kong does not belong to China. But precisely because of that, they more strongly identify themselves as Hong Kongers. So youth could be a very interesting dimension of the activism in Hong Kong and Taiwan, but I think they are global and the local issue. And what makes it so explosive is the mix of these two together.
Sure. No, I mean, I think Hong Kong is such an interesting example. I mean, it's even, you know, you mentioned that break in 1997, the transfer of authority there between the British and the Chinese. I mean, I think that adds such an interesting dynamic there. Sure. For these people that were born before and after that and influencing these movements. You know, I think an interesting point you draw in the book, you know, there's so many similarities between these two movements, as you've mentioned already. But there's also plenty of differences. And I think one of the clearest differences is the level of success the two had. You know, the Sunflower Movement obviously was, you know, it's controversial to some degree, but was largely successful in, you know, preventing the Ma administration from really pursuing greater ties with China. Mm-hmm. But the Umbrella Movement really, I mean, it got some concessions, but was generally sort of failed to result in a large policy change in the Hong Kong government. So I'm interested to hear what you think. You know, you provide insight on this in your book, but what are the factors that led to this difference in terms of success? You know, what are the organizational factors of a movement that you think, you know, makes it successful? And what's needed in terms of leadership, messaging, negotiating tactics to achieve a successful outcome? And why did this, why was there a difference in these two movements?
It can be tricky if we define use the criteria of success or failure to see a social movement for a number of reasons. But generally, yes, you are right that sunflower movement is generally seen as a successful, whereas umbrella movement is seen as a failure. But it's a matter of interpretation. But I think one of the two main differences in both movements is that sunflower movement has strong leadership. The student leaders were inside of the legislature, and they have been able to execute the decision. Like, they want to have a rally, and now when the timing is no longer good for the movement and people were less, become fewer and fewer in the occupation zone, they decided to time to withdraw. And as in the timing withdrawal, even there are some people who really don't want to leave. And the fact that they are able to execute their decision was very important. The longer some from when drag on, I think the outcome might be different. Police might be rushed in and everyone can be evicted. Whereas what happened in Hong Kong, that they do have leaders, but not for a number of reasons that the leadership does not really work. First of all, on the very first day, it began with the three occupation zone that is not connected to each other. And also, Hong Kong situation is much, much, much more difficult. And the student has tried many ways to execute exit strategy. But people who stay in the occupational or they become fewer and fewer, those are the diehards. They will not get home without getting anything. So when it's a logic of Occupy movement that the longer you drag on, and people get tired and the morale is declining, and also people who don't really care about that have become more and more impatient because you are interrupting their daily life, traffic are blocked. So really, you can in a way you can say that umbrella movement ended in collapse because people are exhausted. And one of the reasons is that the leader cannot really. They know the timing is no longer good, but they cannot persuade people to retreat and with dignity. So that's really the organizational problem with the umbrella movement. But it's not predictable because no one really predicts the emergence of this Occupy movement. And when they come in the shape you see. But one is the occupation of the legislature in Taiwan. The other is three low occupation and three zones that are disconnected with each other in Hong Kong.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's so interesting to talk about these social movements. I mean, I think there's a lot of people these days that talk about them as though they are these, you know, centralized programs that are led by a central person. But in reality, I mean, as you've talked about, they're organic. You know, they come out of grievances, they come out of, you know, generational issues. And that's then
right. You really cannot turn that ahead. Yeah.
Right. And it's so difficult to really make them a coherent movement, as you can see between these two movements.
I mean, Michelle, I would like to move on to one of the questions that's more related to the present and possibly to the future. So we're going to talk a lot about the Sunflower Movement and Umbrella Movement today. And how do you see these two movements has influenced the current protest in Hong Kong? And so do you see like echoes of these part movements and the behaviors of demonstrators, or do you think the current protests have like an organization capacity necessary to continue to challenge Beijing in the future?
Yeah, speaking of the anti-extradition protests that really emerged in June 2019, that one has been more than 5 years after the ending of the umbrella movement. So when umbrella movement ended, it really brought a lot of frustration to people who were deeply involved. But a lot of things happened within these 5.5 years. But I think one of the characters is that Hong Kong activists really learned the lesson of umbrella movement. So they tried to do something different this time. For example, there was leaders, what they Hong Kong call main stage. At that time, in 2014, and it does not work. As I said, the leadership cannot reach a decision. A decision cannot be executed, so there's a problem of leadership. So this time, there is no main stage. People just improvise what they want to do on the street. So if you're going to do a peaceful rally, go ahead. And you want to be more militant, you want to challenge the police, you want to build roadblock, and people just do that. So, and also, because of the very frustrating experience of a prolonged Occupy, And this time, what Hong Kong people were practicing what they call be water philosophy. That is, don't stick to a place too long. Don't try to maintain a occupy a public space, and because that doesn't work. So this time, you saw the hit and run guerrilla style protests emerging in a number of places.
Right.
And also the other lesson is that because the three occupation zones in 2014 are all in downtown areas, and Before the movement collapsed, a lot of activists came to the thinking that they should go to the community instead of holding the ground here because it's become more and more meaningless. So what happened since last year is that they tried to help demonstration, rally in different suburban towns. So you see every week that they have a rally in different areas. And so more and more people got involved. And also police become more aggressive in using their tear gas. A lot of neighbors got involved and got angry out of that. So it kind of this kind of strategy of evenly spread out really make police more and more unpopular. So all together, I think for Hong Kong, what happened last year in Hong Kong is a very resilient movement. Precisely because there is no leaders. So you see Joshua Wong have been arrested for a number of times during the whole process, but the movement still continue because it becomes so organic, it doesn't really need a person to give the decision. And people just do what they saw they fit, so fit. So people who can be more militant on the street, they do that. And a lot of people were taking care of the logistic issue, provide food, provide max supply or anti-gas masks, for example. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were doing like design work. A lot of people were engaging with international lobbying. So it's kind of an organic and multidimensional campaign that make it really difficult to be surprised. I think these are really the lessons they learned from 2014, and now they develop it and to a certain high level that the I think is super sophisticated. That you see, actually, a lot of protests right now, like Belarus and Thai protests, they actually take the clues from what Hong Kong were doing last year.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting hearing what you said about the umbrella movement, that, you know, initially a weakness was that it was kind of poorly organized, that it, you know, it started from three separate movements and kind of came together, but that lack of centralization, that kind of diffuse nature actually has turned into a strength for it too, that it prevents it from being sort of decapitated by the Chinese.
Yes, that's right. That's right. People learn, people evolve. But at the same time, you can say the Hong Kong government also evolved. So they take more aggressive policing, and it's a dialectic. It is always a dialectic between government and a protester. So you never know which side will win eventually, actually.
Of course. I mean, I think, you know, we are the Global Taiwan Institute. Taiwan is a big focus for us. And it's been so interesting reading Taiwan's perspective on the ongoing protests in Hong Kong. You know, I think there's a lot of rightful worry in Taiwan, both, you know, amongst Taiwanese people and Taiwanese watchers, you know, in the U.S. and abroad, that, you know, kind of watching how China handles what it regards as a wayward territory, and, you know, how it handles putting down dissent, and a lot of fear over, you know, could this happen to Taiwan? So I think there's also been some controversy over what Taiwan can do for these protests, you know, as Taiwan is watching another territory kind of fall prey to Beijing. You know, what can the Tsai administration do to help those in Hong Kong? You know, can Taipei actually provide support for these people without antagonizing China further, or is that, you know, almost outside of the bounds of what they can do?
Yeah, it's a very delicate question. That
of course,
if it's just a civil society, that would be easy. Actually, a lot of help coming from Taiwan's NGOs, students, church, try to help Hong Kong's, whether when the movement was still on the street or when the movement had been declined and people were trying to fled out of Hong Kong and take refuge here. You see a lot of help coming from civil society, but that's easier. But if government were to do that, a lot of consideration have to be taken into consideration. Like, for example, like you were actually, what we were doing, if government tried to protect the failed refugee, you will be very provocative for Beijing, because these are the wanted fugitive and you were saying we are going to protect them. So right. A lot of things Taiwan government have been doing can only be put in low profile, and that will be quite problematic, because a lot of Hong Kong people have high expectation of the Taiwanese government. Right. They think they should do more. Like for example, we don't have asylum law, so Taiwan is officially not accepting any political asylum seekers. So mm-hmm. when Hong Kong came here, what Taiwan government do is try to put it in different category of visa. And it's very difficult for they to get like a working visa, the most easier one for young people is ask them to get a student visa, and they can stay here, and they have their residency, so they can get health insurance and so on and so on. But the problem is that a lot of young people who came here, who fled from Hong Kong, didn't want to study, or maybe they have been quit. Like some of them are in their 20s, they have left school for a long time. But that's being a student would be the only way that they can be legally reside in Taiwan. So they have to be encouraged. They were encouraged to become student, but that's against their intention. So they have been dilemma here, because we don't. Unless there is a major revision of the law, so sure. Otherwise, these people can be treated as a temporary resident here. So there is no a place for them to become naturalized or future first steps. So it's very difficult here. So that's a problem that, and because civil society activists have been arguing that we should make a political asylum law,
right.
But that would be another issue, because legally or constitutionally, we don't recognize Hong Kong and mainland China as another country. So by accepting them as political asylum, meaning that legally you don't see Hong Kong as part of your country. And I know it sounds weird, but that's a legal problem. It's no less than declaration of Taiwan independence. Right, because prior to the Hong Kong crisis, mainland Chinese dissident have been coming to Taiwan, Tibetan activists coming to Taiwan, all had these kind of problems. Because legally, according to the Republic of China Constitution, they are not foreigners. They are nationals. It does not make logic reasoning that you give protect asylum to people who regard it as your nation. So there's a legal problem there. I just want to emphasize this. It's kind of big there. Yeah.
No, I mean, it clearly puts Taiwan in such a difficult situation, especially the administration. I mean, I think there's been so many people calling for Taiwan to do something more about it with the asylum law. But as you've made clear, I mean, it's almost so difficult for the administration to really do that without, you know, drastically altering the balance of, you know, tensions in the strait.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you've done a great job. I like that you've talked a lot about the past, about 2014, and done a great job of linking to the present right now. And now I'm going to ask you to do something that everyone will ask you to do that is very difficult, which is look to the future. So I wish you the best of luck. I think there's so many people looking at the Hong Kong protests right now and thinking, you know, what's next? What's going to be the thing that drives us forward? Is this going to fizzle out somewhat like the umbrella movement? Or is it, as you've mentioned, this is an enduring movement, a pretty durable movement that's decentralized, that has people operating throughout the city and around the world? You know, given your expertise on the Sunflower movement, umbrella movement, and just social movements in general, especially, you know, related to China, are you optimistic or pessimistic about what's going forward? You know, and I know that's a difficult question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, of course, you know, this movement has been quite active for several months in last year. But come 2020, we know first in January we have COVID-19. And starting in July, we have national security law that basically makes force every activist, every campaign underground. So went to underground. So Hong Kong's politics, of course, are much more subdued right now, and more of the activists are involved in overseas people who are trying to do lobbying. You see Nathan Law have been quite active. And also some organizing in overseas Hong Kongers community. But in Hong Kong itself, because you cannot really gather in the street, it's against the law, and so a lot of restriction there. So you don't see a movement vibrancy. But I think that the momentum is still there, even though it may change into a more safer channel. People were still doing their things, and so I think it's just a temporary setback. But I don't think Hong Kong people are going to give up, because they have overseas strengths. But the problem is, I think I want to emphasize is that prior to last year, I think there had been a possibility, and some of the Hong Kongers were looking for that possibility, that there's a peaceful coexistence of Hong Kongers' demand for democracy and PRC system on the mainland. Okay, they want to build a war, and actually that's the thinking of umbrella movement. They're just focusing on the city's democracy. They don't want to entanglize PRC. They don't want to intervene in the mainland issues. So they just want the city of city's democracy. But more and more, I think this possibility has been ruled out. One of the reasons is Xi Jinping's grasp of power and become more aggressive in pushing a lot of control on many fronts. And also because of the national security law, which basically has broken the promise of one country, two systems. So they have, right now we can say safely that there is no peaceful coexistence of communist dictatorship on the mainland and cities democracy. That's not possible. So we are really witnessing an interesting time. And I think a lot of Hong Kongers will probably agree with me that ultimately the city's future is not going to be decided by Hong Kong alone. Maybe it's not going to be decided by Beijing alone. I think with more and more tension between China and the Western country, I think these international dynamics are going to really decide the city's future. So it's become complicated. But in the long term, of course, I'm optimistic. I think Xi Jinping is facing a major crisis on many fronts. And on many issues, I think China has overextended its capacity. A breaking point is probably on the horizon. And there is no telling what will happen afterwards. So I think Hong Kong, actually from last year, you see Hong Kong know that. They know that they have to do something drastic, because otherwise the status quo is sliding. They cannot maintain the status quo forever. The Chinese communist is already changing the city. So either you choose a slow death, or you want to upset the status quo, and that is what we have right now. So,
sure.
I don't know. It's very complicated, but I don't think.
Of course.
I'm optimistic about Hong Kong's resilience and their determination to restore their freedom and democracy. But the problem is that before that, how many people are going to be sacrificed? That's something I'm really worrying about.
Of course. No, I mean, it's been so interesting to watch. I mean, it's been so discouraging to watch too, but it's been amazing watching this current movement and, you know, the past movement and the umbrella movement in Hong Kong, how there's been this shift. You know, I think the umbrella movement was well covered in Western media, but not to the extent of these, you know, current protests that have really, you know, I think like you said, these current protesters have learned from the past. They are digital, you know, natives. They've grown up with this technology, where they've done such a good job of sort of publicizing their plight internationally and really internationalizing these protests, which really, you know, puts extra strain on Beijing. I think it's really been fascinating.
Of course. Last year, I'm always amazed by what Hong Kong can do. They are so resourceful and creative.
It's incredible. It really is. Well, Mingxiao, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I really do. I think we both really appreciate you giving us this really helpful context on these movements that I think, you know, I think in our last podcast last week or last month, it was a big theme was that things move so quickly in the vicinity of Beijing, you know, so things move so quickly in Hong Kong and Taiwan that it's really easy to kind of forget things that happened relatively close in time. You know, there's so many different events happening that it's easy to push things to the back of your mind.
No, and I have a feeling it's a moment of acceleration. So, we're witnessing history actually right now.
Exactly. You know, and I think it's right now looking at these current Hong Kong protests, I think it's more important than ever that we understand what led to them, what informed them, what drove these people to this point, and what, you know, could inform them moving into the future. So I think, you know, I think your book came out at an incredibly important time. I mean, it's recent history, but at the same time, it's incredibly important history to remember right now that these movements, this current Hong Kong protest didn't occur in a vacuum. You know, it is a product of years of social mobilization and movements. And I really appreciate that you took the time to talk about it and share your book with us. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure of having a conversation with you.
Perfect. So before we go, I'd like to encourage all of our listeners and really anybody who's interested to check out both of Mingxiao's books. The first is Working Class Formation in Taiwan, Fractured Solidarity and State-Owned Enterprises from 1945 to 2012. And for those who are interested in what we're talking about today, the second book is Challenging Beijing's Mandate of Heaven, Taiwan's Sunflower Movement and Hong Kong's Umbrella Movement, both of which are available on Amazon, and I really can't recommend either of them enough. So again, thank you, Dr. Ho, for joining us.
Thank you, Marshall. Thank you, Jack.
All right. Well, thank you again to all of our listeners and to all of our staff for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. For more information on GTI and our work, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts, and also on our website's podcast page. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.